We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. For almost 2 weeks now, demonstrators have been gathering on the grounds of the Wisconsin Capitol to protest a bill proposed by Governor Scott Walker that would take away almost all of their collective bargaining rights. Saturday's turnout was the biggest yet, with an estimated 70,000 people turning out. Similar rallies have taken place in other states, Indiana and Ohio among them, and there are other states, including those, but also Tennessee, Idaho, Iowa, Kansas, where they're considering similar kinds of legislation. In many places, hard-pressed state governors say that state workers have to make concessions to help close big budget gaps, but union officials say that it's not really about the money. They say it's about weakening organized labor. In this hour of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about what has been going on here in the last couple of weeks in Wisconsin. I'd also talk about recent developments in labor relations in the United States. And our guest for the program is Richard Hurd. He is a professor of labor studies at Cornell University. He specializes in trade union administration and strategy. He's been quoted widely in national print and broadcast media on various labor issues, and a lot of his research has focused on professional workers. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. People who are listening can join in the conversation. We hope that people will make their comments brief so we can keep moving along and keep them on the topic, but questions are welcome if you'd like to call in. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. 333-9455 is a local number, 800-222-9455. That's the toll-free. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that to will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are certainly welcome. And Professor Hurd, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I think that there are some people who have looked at what's going on in Wisconsin and also in other states as well. And they have said that they think that's probably the first time we've seen this much pressure brought to bear on public sector unions, or at least they would say this is the most serious threat to organized labor since Ronald Reagan fired the air traffic controllers back in 1981. Do you think that that is in fact true and there's that much at stake here for organized labor?
Well, I think this is a more serious threat than Ronald Reagan firing the air traffic controllers. In that situation, we were talking about 11,000 federal workers who actually understood when they went on strike that it violated their contract, it violated federal labor relations law, and so they were taking a risk. And in that situation, Ronald Reagan was enforcing the law, no matter how aggressive his stance was and no matter what questions you might raise about it. Currently, what we have is a number of states, at least half a dozen, probably more, where the governor and the legislature are looking at ways to take away bargaining rights from hundreds of thousands of workers across the country, not simply the 11,000 air traffic controllers. But it certainly is the most serious threat that public sector unions have faced since the states started passing laws back in the 1960s and 70s.
Mm. So you think that it is true, as Rich Trumka, the president of AFL-CIO, says that while on the one hand the governor says, well, this is really about money and it's about trying to deal with the money problems in the state, Rich Trumka says, no, this is all about union busting. Do you think that that is true?
Well, I'm not sure union busting is exactly the best phrase to use, but clearly, it's about taking away the rights of public sector workers to be represented effectively in a bargaining framework. And in that sense, it's union busting. It's certainly addressed at the union's ability to represent the workers. and the legal protections that they have. And when you take those away, it makes it much more difficult for public sector unions to do their jobs. That really is the primary aspect of the proposals to change bargaining law that we see very aggressively in Wisconsin right now, and that have been put on the table in a number of other states. So really, we're talking not about simply balancing a budget. We're talking about also changing the right of workers to be represented by unions. If you look across the country, there are a number of states that have very serious budget problems, in fact, much more serious as a share of the budget than Wisconsin faces right now. And in those states, the governors are negotiating with unions. They're not trying to change the law. So you can deal with budget problems in a couple of different ways in terms of how this relates to public employees. One way is to try to figure out how to save money. Another way is to try to figure out how to save money and at the same time weaken unions. And that seems to be what's going on in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
Well, what is it possible to say what makes the difference between those states where the government is taking this more aggressive sort of tactic and those where government and workers are actually sitting down and trying to work these sorts of things out around a table?
Well, part of it relates to the political reality of the state and who's in control of government. If you have a government that's bipartisan, where you have Democrats in control of some branches and Republicans in control of other branches of the government, then you have to try to figure out how to work out compromises. If you have Democrats in control, it's unlikely that a Democratic governor would try to attack bargaining rights in a widespread way. Take New York, where there's a Democratic governor, a Democratic assembly, and a Republican Senate. In New York, the governor faces very serious budget problems. We're talking about on the order of $9 billion. And what he is doing is he has made some very aggressive proposals in terms of cost saving, but he's also dealing with the unions in negotiations. Their contracts expire March 31st. And he's made it very clear to them that layoffs are on the table, that controls on wages, probably a pay freeze, is on the table, that steps have to be taken to reduce the deficit in regard to pension commitments and other things. So he's being very aggressive, but he's bargaining. And he's sitting down with the unions and he's negotiating a settlement. That's what you typically see in states where the Democratic Party, which has closer ties to the labor movement, is in control. And even in states like New Jersey, where there's a conservative Republican governor, that's a state where public sector unions are firmly entrenched, where it's a state where Democrats and Republicans typically share power in some way. And even Governor Christie of New Jersey, at least so far, has not attempted to challenge the bargaining rights of public sector workers because it just doesn't make any sense for him politically. In the states where it's happening, where the governors and or the legislature are going after bargaining rights, you tend to have more conservative Republicans in control, and they're using this opportunity and the reality of the budget shortfalls to attack unions and try to weaken them because they're their political enemies. Mm.
And again, to make a point of why this should be so important to organized labor, not just unions that have public employees in them, but generally organized labor, is that if you take a look at where union membership is strongest, well, that's the place. In the private sector, only about 6% is unionized, but more than a third of public employees belong to unions.
Well, yeah, that's true. But even in the private sector, we're only just under 7% are union members. There's been no effort to eliminate bargaining rights. In fact, if anything, bargaining rights have been expanded just a bit in the past couple of years with some changes for workers in the transportation sector and some other changes. So there's no attack on bargaining rights in the private sector. There is an attack on bargaining rights in some states in the public sector. And at this particular juncture in the labor movement, public sector workers are slightly more than half of all union members. So it's certainly more noticeable and more important to labor than it might have been at a time when the private sector was the dominant share of the union movement.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Richard Hurd. He is professor of labor studies at Cornell University. And we're talking about recent developments in labor relations and the kinds of demonstrations that we've seen recently in Wisconsin, also other sorts of places, as state governments there move aggressively to deal with their budget problems and at the same time move to restrict the right of their public workers to bargain collectively. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about the history of bargaining rights for state workers, and I think what's particularly interesting here, the fact that it's going on in Wisconsin, is that Wisconsin was actually the first state to pass a collective bargaining law for its workers.
Yes, it's intriguing. If you look back at the history of bargaining law, the first group of workers to get bargaining rights were postal workers, and that was way back in 1908. So we actually had public sector workers were the first ones to have a right to unionize, but they were federal. After that, though, there were no moves to give public sector workers the right to bargain until we got up to 1959 with the law in Wisconsin. 3 years later, in 1962, President Kennedy issued an executive order which gave federal workers other than postal workers the right to bargain. And in the aftermath of that, we had a whole series of states passing laws that gave public sector bargaining rights. But there's no federal law that requires states to have bargaining laws for their public sector workers. It's not a federal mandate. It's a state-by-state choice. So most of the states during the 60s and 70s and some on into the 80s and even a couple since then passed laws that gave some or all of their public sector workers the right to negotiate. Now, that happened, all of that happened in the context of much stronger private sector unionization. So the private sector unions were supportive and worked politically with public sector unions to get the right to bargain and represent workers in the public sector, to give those workers the same right to a formal voice in the workplace that workers in the private sector have had since 1935. And since then, the union rights were established in the public sector across the country, starting in Wisconsin, as you mentioned, and in other states, almost all patterned after private sector law, using in some cases the same language as the private sector law. But it basically said workers have a right to have a say. They have a right, if a majority of them choose to exercise that right, to have some formal relationship with the employer where the terms and conditions of employment are spelled out in a contract that's legally binding on both sides. The big difference between the public sector and the private sector is that public sector workers do not have the right to strike. There are a few places where they have some limited right to strike in certain parts of the public sector, but overall, public sector workers don't have the right to strike. Private sector workers do. So for public sector workers, what public sector unions have done is they've developed other methods to exercise leverage to try to get good terms of employment and good language in their contracts, and usually that's tied in some way to political action. And so it sort of ends up all going full circle, and that gets us to where we are today, since political action is how you have to get things done. You don't have leverage from a strike. Public sector unions are active politically, and conservative politicians who oppose what the public sector unions want to do find an opportunity here in 2011 to try to attack and weaken those unions and take those rights away that were established 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Just to go a little further on this, as you point out, private sector workers' rights, they were insured by federal law. That came with the National Labor Relations Act of 1935.
Right.
And from reading about this, it's my understanding that at that time, when it came to the question of public employees, that not only did the president, Franklin Roosevelt, oppose collective bargaining for the public sector, so did George Meany, first president of the AFL-CIO. Why didn't public employees get the same right that private sector workers did?
I'm not sure George Meany is the person you're talking about, because he didn't become president until a bit later.
All right.
But that was 1955. And he may have originally had some caution about public sector unionization, but he supported did support public sector unions throughout most of his time as president of the AFL-CIO, which went from 55 until he died in the late 1970s. So But that's not the really the main point that you're making. At the time, now think of it this way. This is 1935. No workers, the only workers that have a right to unionize are postal workers, and by then, workers in the railroad industry had also gained the right to representation. So you only had two laws on the books that gave bargaining rights, one for postal, one for railroad, both very important in interstate commerce. And now we're talking about, should workers have a federally protected right to unionize? And at that time, it is true that Franklin Roosevelt opposed making this law or passing a law that applied to public sector workers as well. And there was sort of a philosophical issue of workers in the public service, should they have a right to shut down employment? And that was really, I think, the main question that was being considered. Should public sector workers have the same right to exercise leverage and go on strike against the people, which is what was the rationale, and President Roosevelt said no, but private sector workers do. Now, think of this. There's no real legal right to unionize for most workers, and you're taking it one step at a time. Of course, the current Republicans now are making hay with the quotes from President Roosevelt way back in the 1930s. What changed after the 1930s is the public sector became larger. It became more important, in part because of initiatives pursued by Roosevelt with the New Deal and the expansion of the federal government and comparable expansion at the state level, decisions to expand public education, to expand welfare programs during the 1960s. And so the role of the public sector became far more important. It was not just a small part of our economy. It was an important part of our economy, and that was widely accepted during that time. And also during this time, the supporters of public sector unions reached a decision that they would never get bargaining rights unless they conceded that they should not have the right to strike. And that was really the main issue. And so they accepted public sector laws that made it impossible for them to strike, so they couldn't go on strike against the public, which is, you know, at least in terms of the rhetoric that was used. And instead, they had to use reasoned discourse, long-term negotiations. It's not unusual in the public sector for a contract to expire and for workers to continue to work without a new contract for 6 months or a year or 2 years until another one's negotiated. They don't have the same kind of recourse as private sector unions, so it's a slower, more methodical, more reasoned, even-handed, less contentious process than you see in the private sector. So a form of bargaining and a form of representation was created that suited the public sector and basically avoided all of the main opposition to public sector unions.
We have a caller here. Let's bring them into the conversation. Line one in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. Something that's bothered me is what I see as a disconnect between the media in general. WILL is an exception, I suppose, with this interview, but the media in general and the politicians as well, in that no one seems to mention that the large studies that have been done, for example, Gallup poll and so forth, the most recent ones, have noted that some 61% of all Americans support the bargaining rights of public workers. And that's a very strong majority. And the one thing they also don't note typically is that, from what I understand, Walker is not going up against the police and firefighters unions because they're Republican supporting. He's rather specifically targeting teachers and so forth. And I wonder if you want to say something about that. Another thing is that, how did we get here? You know, we have what is clear, according to most economists, deregulation that went, you know, amok over the course of the 90s and into the early 2000s. And now you have basically workers being, it's treated in this kind of fashion in a way that is very different, I think, from the general trend after the Great Depression, despite the one example of Roosevelt. Certainly the general trend was to respect workers' rights and to increase regulation. And so I just wonder if you could speak to how it is we've gotten here, perhaps what is the rhetoric that is sort of fed into a kind of anti-worker bias in many cases.
Sure. There's a number of things that you raised, so I'll try to take them as in order if I can, and let me know if I miss anything. In terms of the disconnect between the media and the public and between politicians and the public in terms of public opinion, we have to be careful. I mean, it's absolutely true that the Gallup poll that was released, which is the most nuanced poll that's been done, did show support for for Wisconsin workers, even more than 61%, if you just asked, do you support the workers? And then if the general public was asked, do you support bargaining rights, 61% said yes. I don't expect that that's going to change a lot. But also, if you ask, do you support the public sector unions, the number goes down. So it's a mixed situation. The general public is sort of, they believe, sure, you should have rights. Sure, you should have the right to speak and to represent yourself and to have some say. And I think people see that as part of a democracy, to have the ability to be at the table and to talk about what kind of conditions you face in the workplace. Now, in terms of the other parts of what you talked about, Walker and his attitude toward this. The question is, what's going to happen in Wisconsin? And I think the politicians in Wisconsin, given that the people in charge are actually quite conservative, they're not moderate Republicans that work with unions, they're conservative Republicans that really have no history of an alliance with unions. I think they're either ignoring the public opinion polls, or they've decided that this is a passing thing and it's not going to hurt them politically. Or they're ideological enough that they're going to stand by their position in terms of their political views and pursue the policies that they've put forward and the proposals that they've put forward, regardless of what the public thinks. It's hard to know what goes on inside the closed rooms of the Wisconsin Republican elected officials. It is ironic that police and firefighters have been omitted from this. Part of that is political, that police and firefighters often, or more often than other unions, support Republicans. Also, they're less politically active, especially police are less politically active than other unions, and so they're not as much of a threat come election time. And the public loves police and firefighters, you know, so why take them on? But also, when these politicians talk about the excesses in the public sector, they often talk about huge pension plans and the ability to retire early and continue to earn wages while they're on pensions, and most of the examples of that are police and firefighters. Whether this is good or bad, it's ironic that they let the police and firefighters off the hook in Wisconsin, and that's not the only place. For instance, the only workers who have a right to union representation in Texas are firefighters, and that's a very conservative state, as you probably know. So there is some irony here. That the unions that in some sense have the greatest excesses in terms of some of the financial things are the ones that are being left off the hook, but they also tend to be either less politically active or more conservative. And then tying this all back to the whole move toward deregulation. Of course, these people, the more conservative Republicans, are very free market oriented and anti-government anyway, and their solution for the government problems would be privatization. You know, you get rid of government jobs and you put them in the private sector. In the private sector, of course, the workers would have the right to unionize. But right now, with public sector unions as weak as they are, especially in the service sector, so the kind of work that might be contracted out to the private sector, such as custodial work, street cleaning, garbage collection, all of those kind of things, those jobs tend to be very low wage, very low skill, and very low unionization. So privatization is a whole part of, and shrinking the public sector is a whole part of this free market ideology that's supported by conservative Republicans, and ties in with deregulation. And that ties in with deregulation of the entire economy, which raises environmental questions and financial regulation questions and all kinds of things that take us in a very different direction that we're talking now. But it is important to remember that this is part of that big picture.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, thank you
very much.
Well, just I appreciate the fact that you would say that you wouldn't know what would be going on behind closed doors as Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin talk about what it is that they want to do. But as you look at this particular situation, it seems that the governor has the votes. That the only reason this hasn't gone through the legislature is, as we know, a number of Democratic senators from Wisconsin left the state, and they're presumably hanging out somewhere in northern Illinois, and that's the reason that it hasn't gone through. But the question is, well, can they do that forever? And I think probably the answer is not really. And it sounds as if from what you were saying is that you don't think that the Republicans are in much of a mood to negotiate on this.
Well, they certainly so don't appear to be, and the question will be played out. We'll get the answer to that as time goes on. But It seems to me like they're willing to take their chances, and it would not be shocking, no matter how anyone feels about this, it would not be shocking for at least core aspects of this proposal to be put into law within the next month or two. But that doesn't mean that the story's over. I mean, it's going to be going on in these other states. But one thing that's happened, public sector union membership tends to be sort of quiet and calm and just let things sort of take their course. But this has certainly awakened them. And public sector workers, whether they're strong union members or just sort of passive about it, have become much more engaged, much more concerned. And I don't think they're going to just run away if this law passes. I would suspect they're going to become even more aggressive. And it'll be very interesting to see how this plays out, not simply this year, but in the elections that are happening next year and 3 years from now. It'll be very interesting to see how all of this impacts union political activity, mobilization of workers in the public sector. It's actually also brought public and private sector unions together, because private sector unions have sort of been letting the public sector unions deal with these problems on their own. And suddenly they see it's a big deal, and they realize that when the right to representation is being attacked, then they could be next if that happens. And so you have more cohesion and unity in the labor movement than we've seen in quite some time. You even have the AFL-CIO unions working closely with the National Education Association, which is independent, and with the Change to Win unions. They formed a very tight coalition to respond to these problems. So one thing that's come out of this is unity of the labor movement.
And I think that's one of the most interesting developments, and one of the things that people would point to and say, well, maybe in a way this is good for organized labor, because it's gotten people to pull together, and it maybe has prompted some people who didn't really think very much about why unions are important to think about that and say, well, yes, perhaps workers should have the right to organize, and it's something that that should be supported. I mean, after all, now the percentage of Americans that are in unions, or maybe even have someone in their family that are in unions, is the smallest that it's ever been.
Yeah, actually, private sector unionization is the lowest it's been since the early 1900s. So that's something people don't quite recognize. And unionization here, for instance, if you look across the border in Canada, where the laws on the books look pretty much the same as here, there's some slight differences. Actually, there, public sector workers do have the right to strike. Yet they have unionization that's well over twice as high as union density in the United States. So you can see that you can have the same set of laws, but a different level of worker voice being expressed through the bargaining process. And what's happening now is people are being forced to think about it in the U.S. That's one thing that Wisconsin has done. It may or may not play out well for the labor movement. It may be a real bad result, and unions may well be weakened in the public sector. But there's also the chance that it's awakened the unions. They're going to become more assertive. And at least right now, I think the public's still sorting this out and trying to figure out where they stand on this. Because the poll that the Gallup poll that we talked about a couple of minutes ago does in general show support for unionization, especially collective bargaining rights. But other polls have been less positive, although less nuanced and less detail asked, have been less positive. So I think the public's still trying to sort this out. And so it's very important for the unions to be careful how they proceed and demonstrate that they can be reasonable and can work with governments to solve the budget problems while at the same time protecting the bargaining rights. And if they do it responsibly, I think the chance that the public sector attitude toward unions will improve is greatly enhanced.
Our guest in this hour is Richard Hurd. He is an economist by his academic training. He's professor of labor studies at Cornell University. He's leading specialist on trade union administration and strategy. He often speaks in the media on labor issues. A lot of his research has focused on professional workers, and we're talking about the recent worker demonstrations in Wisconsin and also in other states, as public workers, government workers, have rallied against proposals that have been made in many states, and among them Wisconsin, also Indiana, Ohio, other places that would restrict their right to bargain collectively. The questions are welcome. In fact, the lines are all full, so we'll get right to it. We are past our midpoint here, and folks will help us by being brief. We'll try to get in everybody that we can, starting with a caller in Belgium, and that's line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Mm-hmm.
I want to bring up another slightly sort of topic to this. This Mr. Walker in Wisconsin is a strong teabag party member who's being highly, highly, highly financed by the Koch brothers, and they do not want to see anything going along the line with anything to do with the middle class. And the unions, who strongly support Democratic candidates and fund them very strongly, this is a great way to cut back Democratic funding. So the, and since money is all there is in politics anymore when it comes to winning and losing, this sounds like a way to really just totally destroy the Democratic Party.
Well, I'm not sure destroying the Democratic Party is quite the result that's likely, but certainly it creates problems for them. Now, it's important that you mention that money is money plays a big role in the political arena. It's also important to recognize that corporate contributions to political campaigns tend to be bipartisan, with a Republican tilt, but bipartisan, and at much higher levels than union contributions to political campaigns. Just important to keep that in mind as background. Unions can never hope to outspend the Koch brothers of the world. That's not going to happen. But what unions do offer the Democratic Party, and I think this is more of a concern of the Republicans who have found unions to be problematic and a barrier to their political aspirations. And again, I want to mention, it's not all Republicans, but the conservative wing of the Republican Party. The thing that the Democratic Party gains from unions is ground troops during an election campaign. The labor movement is very well organized. They can recruit volunteers to work on campaigns, to staff phone banks, and most important, to work on get-out-the-vote drives as the election approaches. And that's the big difference. That's why unions are so important to Democrats. And public sector unions have been especially effective at getting their members to get engaged in working on, as volunteers, on these political campaigns. So if you weaken unions, and especially if you weaken public sector unions, that takes away a key aspect of the Democratic Party political apparatus. And that's a real problem for the public, for the Democratic Party, and I think that that's part of what's going on here. Also, there's an irony in all of this. The Koch brothers own a lot of companies, a lot of property. They're financially incredibly wealthy. They own unionized companies, which is ironic because there was some discussion among some labor supporters to boycott all of their companies, and then they realized that they own paper mills and other facilities that are unionized. So it's a bit of a difficult tactical choice for labor supporters to figure out exactly how to approach this. And I think it becomes dicey anyway when you start challenging someone for their political contributions if you contribute politically as well. But it is an intriguing set of issues, and I think the important point that you make is this goes well beyond simply bargaining rights and simply negotiating issues, but also involves the whole political arena.
All right. I want to thank the caller and go on to another caller, and that would be somebody in Champaign in line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Maybe the union's getting across the story what the benefits over the long run, what unions have done, in terms of for labor, that kind of thing, and actually other people have benefited from in terms of salaries. Now we're into this situation where people are making less and less money, and the influence of corporations and all the top executives making all that kind of money. If that was distributed a little better, maybe people down at the bottom make a little bit more. You can comment on that. And lastly, I know that the railroads are still pretty strong, aren't they, unions? But that's mostly in the north. Is that correct?
Railroads? Railroads nationally are unionized, and they do have high levels of unionization. Of course, they're less important to our economy than they were back a few decades ago, but they are still heavily unionized.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can respond to some of the other aspects of the caller's question.
Certainly. Let's get back into the other parts. In terms of people making less and less money, part of what's going on here is that the general public in a recession when there are so many people out of work, and even though we're technically not in the recession, we still have 9% unemployment, and higher levels of unemployment are typical in the Midwest, actually. So we have a tough situation with very high unemployment. And people that work in the private sector have not seen their real income go up, and they see their own health care costs going up, and they see their own pensions threatened by the economic downturn. And they turn to the public sector, and they see that the public sector at least appears to be better off than they are. And it creates a certain jealousy, and I think that's part of the reason that politicians like Governor Walker have seen this as an opportunity to take on the public sector unions, because there's a bit of not quite animosity, but ill feelings from workers in, who have it a tough time versus these workers who they perceive as doing extraordinarily well. Well, the public sector workers aren't doing as well as it might appear on the surface anyway. Their wages are not dramatically higher than private sector workers. There are higher wages on average if you just look at the raw data, but public sector workers have much higher level of education overall. There are many more professional workers as a share of the workforce, social workers, probation officers, school teachers, and healthcare workers who are professionals who are working for the government. In general, though, once you account for the difference in education level and the kind of jobs that are done, public sector workers nationwide earn about 10% less than private sector workers. In fact, there have been a number of recent studies. Depends on who does them, exactly how they turn out. But the ones that I've looked at that are most objective seem to indicate pretty consistently this 10%. But there's a lot of variety across the board. So there's a little bit of ill will toward the public sector. And it is ironic that at the same time there's this effort to fan this ill will toward public sector workers, or maybe it's a bit of jealousy, there seems to be less attention to the fact that our income distribution is the most unequal it has been in the past 75 years plus. So we have very unequal income distribution as people at the top end of the income scale have increased their share of income and wealth over the past 20 years, while everyone else's share has gone down. And I think the caller is right that this inequality is something that needs at least to get some attention. But it's easier for a member of the general public to point to public sector workers and say, why do they have it better than I do, than it is for them to point to someone who's way off somewhere, has made it big, is wealthy, and owns three houses and a yacht or whatever. So it is intriguing that that the Tea Party, to their credit, has been able to deflect public or capture public animosity and turn it in one direction rather than another direction. So far, I think we've allowed this inequality to go largely unnoticed and not addressed as aggressively as it might have been.
Well, one more quick follow-up, and again, I have some other callers who want to get onto. I think that while it seems, at least from everything I've read, it seems to be the case, as you say, that if you look at wages in the public and the private sector, and if you control for things like level of education and the kind of jobs that people do, that the public sector workers are paid less. However, it is also true if you look at the benefit side that public workers are more likely to have health care, they're more likely to have a defined benefit pension plan, and that's true regardless of whether or not they're unionized. And I think that in a lot of states the government would say, well, that's really where our problem is. It's not so much the wages that we're paying, it's having to pay the benefits. And certainly pension plans are going to be a big issue. They are here in this state, certainly. We have the dubious distinction of having the most underfunded state pension system in the entire country. So that's going to be, sooner or later, it's going to be an issue everywhere.
Yeah, I think the benefits, you can't ignore that. You can't ignore those issues. It's not that public sector workers have health care benefits that are unreasonable. They have health care benefits that are reasonable, but many other workers have seen their health care benefits decline. And as we create this sort of underclass of service sector workers who are employed at places like Walmart with very low wages and benefits, the differences are even more stark. But if you look in the context of having to deal with the budget, let's look at what's happening again in New York. I don't want to keep returning to New York, but the governor of New York has pointed out we have to do something about health care expenses. We have to do something about pension expenses. And so that's being negotiated with the unions, and changes are going to be made. If you look in the private sector, at unionized companies in the private sector, as the economy has been weak in periods when the economy has been weak off and on over the past quarter century. The unionized companies and the private sector have renegotiated their contracts with the unions, have reduced the generous nature of the health benefits, increased copays, made changes in those, changed their pension plans, in many cases from defined benefit to defined contribution plans. And so through the bargaining process, it's been resolved. Public sector workers in general have, there is a higher percentage of them that have full, strong health care coverage and a higher percentage that have defined benefit pensions. These can be reworked, and it's the negotiating process is the place where you do that.
We have some other callers here. Just very quickly, let me introduce again the guest. We're talking with Richard Hurd. He is professor of labor studies at Cornell University. We have about 10 minutes left. We'll go to our next caller, and that is someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Yes. Some of what I wanted to call about has been already touched on. But one thing that no one seems to mention in Wisconsin is Wisconsin didn't really have a problem before Walker was elected. About the first thing he did was radically cut taxes, precipitating the crisis.
I think that's something that people do need to make sure they include in their equation where they're trying to figure out what's going on there. I'm not privy to all the details of what's happened in Wisconsin in terms of this political the political agenda and the session of the legislature and what's happened since Walker has been governor. It's my understanding that there's been a reduction in corporate taxes. That's, you know, when there's a budget problem, there's two sides of it. There's the revenue side and there's the cost side. And a budget problem can be made worse either by a reduction in revenues or by an increase in cost or by some combination. And so when you're looking to solve a budget shortfall, then you have to look for sources of income and sources of savings. And it appears that the opposite has happened in Wisconsin. It appears, at least, that the budget was in relatively good shape compared to many other states. And then a tax cut was enacted, which created a situation where steps had to be taken to reduce costs in order to make up for the revenue shortfall. So in that kind of environment, that provided the backdrop for this whole fight with the public sector union.
May I say one other thing?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
If you cut benefits to education, to teachers, what's going to happen is they're already not really paid commensurate with their education. They must have a bachelor's degree to get in, and they must have a master's degree in fairly short order. The best teachers are highly desirable employees elsewhere. If they do not have these benefit packages, they have absolutely no incentive to stay in education. And we're going to see a decline in the quality of education.
Well, that's an important part of this whole debate about the quality of education, which is an ancillary topic to what we're talking about today, but very important in the broader discussion of public sector budgets and the role of the public sector, is how do we take on this whole question of quality in education. And one of the interesting aspects of the debate as it's been carried on over the last couple of years is that unions have often been portrayed as the problem rather than part of the solution for the quality in public education issue. But I think the caller is absolutely right that given that pay is less for these public sector jobs compared to workers with similar occupations in the private sector, then the benefits, the somewhat better benefits and the somewhat stronger job security have been the attraction or one of the attractions that's brought people into these positions and kept people in these positions. And to the extent that you make any changes that make any job less desirable, the people who will leave the job first are the ones that have the most alternatives elsewhere. And that's likely to be the people who are the strongest performers in these jobs. So I think the caller's right that you have to recognize that if you start reducing pay, benefits, job security in the public sector, then the public sector workers you're going to lose first are the ones who most easily can move into a private sector job end up with better pay and benefits overall, and then you're left with the people who don't have as many alternatives. And if quality of education is an important priority, that has to be taken into account when you're talking about what kind of decisions need to be made.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller and go on to another. And this is someone in Lovington. It's line three. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
You stole a lot of my thunder on the fact that they're using the wages of the public workers as comparing them to private workers, and that they make so much more that that's already basically been covered. But something that's been very upsetting to me over a period of years now is the fact that so many things that were fought for by the unions, such as the 12-hour or the 8-hour day, is now reverting to 12 hours in all too many places, and two-tier wage systems that where you have the younger workers coming in earning much less than the older established workers, and it seems like we're just sliding backward very quickly, and it's rather upsetting. I just wondered if you comment on that.
Well, you know, I think that's really an important observation. We have to recognize that what's happening now in the public sector has already happened in the private sector. We had a situation a quarter of a century ago where unions in the private sector were strong, where benefits were good, and where pay was good, at least not only in the unionized companies, but in the companies that weren't union but were competing with the unionized companies. You ended up having higher pay, higher benefits because unions were strong. As unions have become weaker, and there's a variety of reasons for that, we could spend the whole hour, which is almost gone, talking just about why unions have declined. But as unions have gotten weaker in the private sector, their bargaining power has changed, and we've seen a lot of changes there that are parallel to the kind of changes that Walker's talking about in Wisconsin right now. And the two-tier pay is part of it. Lower benefits is part of it. Weaker pension plans, that's all come as unions have lost power in the private sector. So if you don't have strong unions, then you do end up relying more on the free market. And in the current environment, that means there's downward pressure on wages and benefits. And so workers in general are hurt by it. And as you have more and more orientation toward free market policies, this provides opportunities for the people who have money to use that money in ways to allow it to grow, so they become wealthier and wealthier as the mass of the working people lose their leverage and lose their share of the overall economy, the overall income stream. And so what you're talking about is absolutely true. It's already been happening in the private sector, and now we see it happening in the public sector. So unless unions are able to make a stand here and reorient themselves so they can regain the public trust and the workers' trust, and unless we have a government that's willing to step in and provide more opportunities for promoting issues of fairness and equality as opposed to issues of efficiency, then I think what we're seeing is a future that could be rather bleak for working people.
We just have a couple of minutes left. Again, I want to thank the caller and go on to Champaign County next. This is line number two. Hello?
A lot of it is apparently communication from the unions. Trumka at least got to say something that I think should also be pointed out, which is that the five states that have done the chat shows this weekend, the five states that don't have collective bargaining for teachers rank in the bottom six or seven nationwide as regarding their educational system, and Wisconsin is actually number two in quality of education overall. So I don't think anyone on that show pointed out what has been brought up here, which is that the governor shot a hole in the budget and then now is using this budget repair bill, which includes some edicts that aren't even related to the collective bargaining that are anti-democratic, as pointed out by Paul Krugman in his Shock Doctrine USA column this past Friday. That I don't know if you want to comment on that directly, but I there's a little time left, but I wonder if you can say something about Mitch Daniels in Indiana, where I forget exactly how many years ago he did this exact same thing without
Yeah, as I understand the Indiana situation, he did it for state employees. So it wasn't, I don't believe it covered all public employees, but I'm really not aware of the details of what happened in Indiana. But now he's going after teachers as well. So there seems to be a follow-up effort there that's what's happening in Wisconsin is more aggressive. It's taking on all public sector workers at the same time. It is true what you mentioned, that if you look at overall wage rates and even the performance during the recent recession in terms of unemployment, the states that don't have public sector laws are some of the states that have had the hardest time. Places like South Carolina have had the hardest time in our recent economic downturn and also have public sector workers, and particularly in the educational arena, the teachers are not paid as well. They don't have as good of benefits. They have a harder time attracting good teachers because they go to those states that do pay better. And those places, for instance, if you go into the South, you have generally lower educational attainment in places like South Carolina. You go next door in North Carolina in a place like Charlotte, where the municipal voters have voted to fund their education system at higher levels, the good teachers in that part of the country tend to gravitate toward places like Charlotte and Atlanta, where the pay and benefits are better. They end up having better results in their educational system. It all sort of fits in together. It all ties together. So I think it's important to keep all of that in mind as we're looking at this whole picture.
And just very quickly, there, in addition to these changes in collective bargaining, I think that there are some other things on the table that people, at least people in labor, worry will make it maybe more difficult for unions there in the state of Wisconsin to organize. And that might indeed lead to have something to do with how they're certified and how it is that the dues are connected and so forth. And some people say, could that, if that happened, would that actually even result in a loss of membership?
Yeah, it would actually. There's all kinds of detailed proposals in Wisconsin and elsewhere. Even in states that don't have this frontal assault on unions, you have small proposals that, or at least seem to be small proposals, that, for instance, require workers to vote every year whether they want to keep their union representation, and require workers to sign every year a form that says they're going to have union dues deducted from their paycheck, or even some proposals as part of what's happening in Wisconsin that say that the state will not collect the dues for the unions, but the unions now has to have staff who go out to the members and collect their dues from them every month, which is an incredible burden on them. It's very simple for the employer to take dues out of a paycheck if the worker says to do it. It's much harder to go worker to worker to collect the dues. So you get all of your staff and all of your attention just directed toward those aspects of staying in business, and you end up not having the effort or the time or the staff to take on the key political issues, the bargaining issues, the representation issues that the workers have. So there are all kinds of detailed proposals on the table here that really would weaken unions generally.
There we'll have to stop. Perhaps we can talk again some point. We'll certainly continue to follow it. Before right now, we have to stop and say thanks to our guest, Richard Hurd. He's professor of labor studies at Cornell University. And Professor Hurd, thank you very much.
Yes, I've enjoyed it.